This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today my guests are Shoaib Ahmed Malik and Jörg Matthias Detterman. Shoaib and Matthias are the editors of Islamic Theology and Extraterrestrial Life, New Frontiers in Science and Religion, published by IB Tauris in 2024. Over the last 30 years, humanity has discovered thousands of planets outside our solar system. The discovery of extraterrestrial life could be imminent. This book explains how such a discovery might impact Islamic theology. It is the foundational reference on the subject, comprising a variety of different insights from both Sunni and Shia positions, from different Muslim contexts, and with chapters that compare and contrast Islamic perspective with Christianity. Together, they address some of our biggest questions through an Islamic lens. What makes humans unique in the cosmos? What are the ethics of dealing with other sentient beings? And how universal is salvation? Given the accelerating advances in exoplanet research and astrobiology, this book is at the frontier of science and Islamic thought. But before we delve into all of this, first things first, Shoaib and Jörg, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
So let's start with the basics. Could you tell us something about yourselves, your interest in Islamic theology and extraterrestrial life? And lastly, how did this book come about?
Thank you so much. I've been a fan of science fiction since my childhood, and I've become especially interested in Islamic and Muslim science fiction since studying the Muslim world in particular. I'm from Europe, but I studied at SOAS, which makes you, Roberto, a fellow SOAS alum and a colleague. And I've became especially interested in Islamic science fiction since moving to Qatar in 2013. And I've been fascinated, for instance, by the futuristic architecture of the Gulf states, the many buildings that look like spaceships while still having some traditional Islamic elements.
So thank you very much, Roberto, for inviting me. I'm very, very grateful to be here. But my journey started off very differently. So I used to be a chemical engineer. I started off with the STEM sciences. And I was really good at chemistry. I was really good at math and physics. And so naturally, engineering became like a go-to option. But it was during my first PhD that I realized it's not something I want to look into. Just due to various personal encounters, I started gaining significant interest in theology and philosophy. And that led me down, a road where I just wanted to understand the Islamic worldview. And I eventually did another postgraduate program and finally got into another PhD for theology. Now, because of my scientific background, I was naturally interested in the field of science and religion. How do these two fields interact with one another? And my first body of research was evolution, given that that's a very controversial area. But evolution then paved the way for aliens. So to some extent, I have an interest in dinosaurs. I love dinosaurs. That's why I love Jurassic Park. But I also love aliens. And so, in terms of like origins, whether there was, one origin on our planet, if there are many origins, and what could that mean for religious believers worldwide is, naturally a fascinating conversation to have. And so when I thought of the idea of having a conference dedicated to, you know, Islam and its intersection with, you know, extraterrestrial life, I approached Matthias because I was already in conversation with Matthias based on his work that he wrote on, you know, science fiction and extraterrestrials in the Muslim world with Ivy Torres. And we just clicked so well. So I said this to him, you know, why don't we have a conference and see what kind of stuff we can get out of this? So we did it at VCU, right? Virginia Commonwealth University in Qatar. And we did this in, I think it was during the height of COVID. So, I mean, when people were, you know, busy about COVID and stuff, we were still trying to keep our time to ourselves and trying to make sure that we do good work. And we were very, very happy to see that so many people from around the world participated. And you know, we've had a global interest. And that led to a phenomenal, what's it called, conference. I think, Matthias, who was it? There was a very interesting father who came in and attended. The name is slipping me. Do you remember? He was a very famous astronomer. The name slips me, but do let me know if you remember that. But he attended as well, and eventually we saw that there was enough here to come up with a production, and this production is what we see in front of you, right? This edited volume, Islamic Theology and Extraterrestrial Life: New Frontiers in Science and Religion, again with Ivy Torres. And I'm just incredibly happy with the final product. So we have 9 different chapters, you know, from 9 different perspectives. We make it very clear that this is not, you know, the finished product of the conversation. It's actually the starting point for the conversation. So we just wanted to, you know, push the button and see where things go. And we hope this sparks a conversation, not just, you know, amongst Muslims or people interested in Islam, but also across multiple disciplines and multiple faiths. That's the origins of the project.
And I think the astronomer that you're referring to, that was Father Jose Funes from Argentina, a former director of the Vatican Observatory. And we were really, really enthusiastic and grateful and happy to have not just Muslims be part of our conference on Islamic perspectives on exotheology, but to also have prominent Christian scholars, Christian astronomers, including this former director of the Vatican Observatory, be part of our conversations.
And since that you mentioned Christianity, let me ask, you know, we are much more used to think about extraterrestrial life in the Western context, particularly in a Christian one. Yet, given that there are 2 billion Muslims around the world, the confirmation of extraterrestrial life elsewhere in the universe will certainly have an impact on Islamic theology and its followers. So can you frame a little bit your work and that of the contributors of the book within the field of astrobiology, if you also can explain briefly what astrobiology is for those that are not familiar with the term?
Astrobiology is the study of life in the universe. It is a very interdisciplinary field. It unites astronomers, biologists, chemists, and it also unites a lot of people who are interested in the societal implications of discovering life elsewhere in the universe. So there are social scientists, there are philosophers working on this topic too, and there are theologians as well who ask the question, what would it mean for us humans if we are not alone in the universe? What if there are other, especially intelligent aliens out there? What would it mean for our worldview, including our religious worldview, if we find out that here, us humanity on our planet Earth, that we are just part of a much, much, much bigger cosmos that is teeming with life? What does this mean for our relationship with a creator God, for instance? What does this mean for questions of human specialness, for questions of theological anthropology? How special are we indeed to God should we find out that there are much more advanced civilizations and cultures out there in the universe?
What you mentioned, Roberto, is generally the widespread and predominant perception of science or religion, which is largely framed through a Christian lens. And naturally, other voices, be it from the Islamic front or the Jewish front, don't get as much traction. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to at least provide a contribution that gave a voice to the second largest religion in the world, which is Islam. And what we want to try and articulate or put out there is that some of the underlying theological axioms or starting points are different, which can lead to very different, significantly different implications for how we understand extraterrestrial life and its impact on theology. For example, in Christianity, we have this concept of original sin. We have redemption. We have the atonement. Those are not theological axioms in Islamic thought. And so naturally, you get into all kinds of interesting differences. For instance, Christian scholars discuss whether the death of Christ, was it just for people on earth or was it on a cosmic scale, right? Whereas that conversation has no bearing in Islamic thought because that's not something that Muslims entertain, right? Just because of the differences between the two religious systems. And so I think that will make for a very fruitful discussion, both within Islam, but also for interfaith dialogue. And that's what we wanted to kind of explore through this project.
You just made me think about a very old episode of Star Trek, the original series. There was an episode that, despite the fact that the series was very much secular, but picked up a similar story about the birth of a child that represented light, so the connection with Christianity. And I guess there was already an early attempt to tackle, you know, the link, what if, we discover life outside our planet and how Christianity would relate to that. But again, it's a very old episode, perhaps worth rediscovering. I want to go back to a couple of terms that you mentioned in the book and are very important, particularly for those who are not familiar with the subject. So if you can define exotheology and astrotheology, which at least in my view, they seems to be almost interchangeable, but I understand there are also some differences.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier the term astrobiology, the study of life in the universe, and it also has an older companion term, exobiology. So there is exobiology and astrobiology, and then there is exotheology and astrotheology. Exobiology deals with life outside of Earth. So the ex referring to something that is outside. This is a somewhat older term. People who are interested in the study of life in the universe would not necessarily see the Earth as separate from the rest of the cosmos. And in fact, they would often connect the study of life on Earth with the study of life in the universe. And I think with these two terms, exotheology and astrotheology, I see something similar. So exotheology being an older term for theology that deals with questions relating to life outside of Earth, whereas astrotheology is a more recent term that is broader and that speaks about theological questions related to life in the entire universe, on Earth as well as outside of Earth. That's at least how I would understand these terms.
Yeah, no, I mean, what you said was bang on. And the person who kind of made these two words famous in the field of science and religion is none other than Ted Peters. So Ted Peters is one of the leading exotheologians, I'd say. He's a Lutheran, as far as I'm aware. And he also very kindly reviewed our book and wrote a blog for it as well. So we're very, very happy to have that. But yeah, Ted Peters kind of put these two words on the map and they just stuck around. And I think that kind of defines the theological side of what would it mean for religious folks around the world if aliens were to exist? What would it mean on the doctrinal front, on the ethical front, on the legal front, or what have you?
I have one more question about the structure of the book. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the sources used by the various authors And I'm sure that many of the listeners are familiar with the Quran, the Hadiths, and Islamic legal thinking. However, given the centrality of these terms, I was wondering if you can elaborate more on these. So to clarify for the listeners and for the reader of the book, what all of this means.
For those of you who are unaware, for your listeners, that is, so the Quran is the central text for Muslims worldwide. And this is something we believe that was revealed to the Prophet from God through or via Archangel Gabriel. And this is the text that we believe has been passed down through the generations until today. And Muslims recite it, we use it in our prayer all the time. And it's something that's the pivotal foundation of the Islamic worldview. In addition to that, we have a secondary source, which are called hadiths. Hadiths are just, you know, the sayings and the actions and the tacit approvals of the Prophet. So the companions of the Prophet and the scholars that came after them, they meticulously narrated these things down through, you know, severe levels of scrutiny to make sure that we have the most accurate depiction of the sayings and the actions of the Prophet. And this was just to make sure that all of this was recorded for the sake of preserving the origin of the religion embedded in the Prophet Muhammad. These two sources then become the basis for a wide variety of disciplines. And there's three main ones for the purposes, at least, of this discussion. One is creed. So we have a tradition of creedal works that came out. And this is where we discuss about, you know, the articles of faith. How do you articulate them? You know, how do you derive them from either the Quran or the Hadith, right? What are the scholarly opinions around them? What are the primary discussions? What are the secondary discussions and what have you? So that's doctrinal stuff. We then have another, this is in Arabic, this is known as Aqidah, or in more advanced forms, Ilm al-Kalam, yeah? Then we have the body of jurisprudence, or known as Fiqh or Usul al-Fiqh. Largely put, in addition to having belief systems, we want to also know how can we derive ethical rulings. And that's where the discipline of fiqh emerged. So using a lot of different machinery, you know, analogical reasoning, absence of mention in scripture, and a bunch of, you know, different legal practices, scholars were able to come up with a wide variety of methods to be able to extract ideas from the Quran and the Hadith to come up with moral judgments. And this is something that's been an ongoing process because, of course, the Quran and Hadith are, to some extent, they don't address every single thing out there. The Quran, you cannot find cryptocurrency in the Quran. You cannot find, some of the latest developments in the Quran, right? So how do we keep the legal framework relevant? This is why there's an ongoing tradition of jurisprudence or fiqh. And just for clarity, fiqh is the output that you get after you process it through this machinery, which is known as usul al-fiqh. And then finally, we have the spiritual component, which is known as the tasawwuf, right? And it's to do with gnosis. It's the kind of having, you know, reaching a station with God on a spiritual level that kind of unveils new realities that you won't necessarily get through, you know, your five senses or through pure rational intellect. So because Muslims believe that you have three components, right? You have body, mind, and heart. And so naturally it fits into these three disciplines. Fiqh regulates your body. It's to do with what you can and cannot do. Aqidah regulates your mind, what you're required to believe. And tasawwuf is to regulate your heart. You know, how do you be the best person that you can be? How do you make sure that you practice piety in every single thing that you do and you believe? And so this is, you know, the rich corpus of Islamic thought. So even though the Quran and Hadith are the main sources for Islam, there's a lot more to Islam than just those two texts. But they are the pillars of everything that comes after.
That's true. Was a wonderful explanation. I would like to add here that out of that corpus, the Quran, of course, is the most important one, and also the source that almost all Muslims would agree on as being the central revelation. With the Hadith, you can find more differences between Muslims about which tradition of the Prophet Muhammad they would prefer, they would use. I should also mention that Shia scholars in particular, and we have prominent scholar of Shia Islam, Muhammad Montasari, as part of our volume. Shia scholars would not only look at the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, but they would also look at the traditions of his son-in-law, Ali ibn Abi Talib, and his successors, the men who are deemed imams in Shia thought. So outside of the Quran, there are some differences in which stories, which narrations are being privileged. But the Quran itself, which is a heavily standardized text, would be important for all Muslims.
Good. Thank you for this exhaustive explanation, which I think is very important for, again, those listeners that might not be entirely familiar with this world. I want to start talking about the chapters and reading the work, the contribution by Hamza Karamali. One has to deal with the question, can intelligent extraterrestrial life exist according to Islam? Will they, ET, be the same as humans? And I guess you can also include in the discussion the following chapter by Muammer Kalaileh. Does the Quran affirm extraterrestrial life?
Hamza Karamali is a very interesting individual. He, you know, he went down the university track. I think he got a degree in computer science, if I'm not mistaken. And he's like, no, I wanna go to the seminary. So he made a U-turn and then went to the seminary system. And now he's a very prominent theologian. He currently lives in Turkey. One of the, you know, he's such a humble individual, very lovely to speak to. A great individual. So he starts off this book by looking at what does Islam actually say about, you know, extraterrestrials. Does the Quran affirm extraterrestrials? Does the Quran deny extraterrestrials? And he looks at this conversation through three aspects: metaphysics, scripture, and science. Right? Metaphysics, in very simple terms, just to keep the conversation going, is simply: is it within the capacity of God to create a world in which there are other intelligent life forms apart from human beings, right? And he argued, yes, it's definitely within the realm of possibility. So at least on that front, there shouldn't be any controversy. Now, does scripture mention anything, yay or nay? This is where Muammar's chapter comes into play. So Muammar analyzes this verse in Surah An-Nahl. It's the 16th chapter, verse 8. And in there, that verse talks about God has created things which you don't even know, right? In very simple terms. And so people have, exegetes, these are individuals who have written commentaries on the Quran. They discussed, you know, what could this entail? And he lists out five different possibilities. One of them being that there very well could be other, you know, intelligent creatures out there. And this is exactly what Hamza concludes in his chapter as well, that it's possible. We don't have any strong thing to go by here or there. So because that is not mentioned in scripture, that scripture cannot ground whether that possibly has existentiated or not. And that's very, very interesting because it leaves open the question, which is then where we get into the science, right? Can science discover, you know, ETIs, yes or no? This is left to the scientists to explore. This is all left to the scientists. So what Hamza tries to do is he gives you this tiered perspective of Islam, showing that, okay, this is what theology can say, and it leaves the door open for what scientists may or may not find. And Muammar seems to corroborate that by just focusing on a particular verse, which is very relevant to this conversation of ETIs.
Thank you, Shaib. And just to add to that, so we are really proud and grateful to have contributors from very different disciplines. Shaib himself, as you said, you're a chemical engineer by training. I'm a historian by training. And we've got philosophers, computer scientists, science fiction authors. And from their different perspectives, they would pretty much all agree that the Quran itself does not negate the possibility of other life in the universe. So in general, like all of our contributors would say, yes, the Quran leaves open the possibility of life in the universe, and at the very least does not object to it at all. And I think Muslims in general would also agree that God is all powerful. And this is something that is repeatedly mentioned in the Quran itself, and that it is therefore absolutely in the powers of God to create other worlds and to create other kinds of being as God wishes.
Let me ask about the chapter by Mohammed Montasseri, mostly because I found it very interested. From a personal perspective, I'm interested in the eschatological thinking of Christian Zionism. Obviously, this is not the topic of the chapter, but he's investigating the potential implication on Islamic, particularly Shia eschatology. And so I was wondering, what are his views about this question? Should extraterrestrial life be found?
So maybe just to explain that term eschatology to start off with, which deals with essentially the end of the world, the end of time, the end of the universe. In Islam in general, this would refer to a day of resurrection. In Arabic, Yawm al-Qiyamah. It's a day that is also called the Day of Judgment. There is a broad understanding among Muslims that rational creatures would be judged for their actions, so that all human beings would be judged. And they would either go to heaven or they would be condemned to hellfire. And this is, of course, a thought that's similar in the other Abrahamic religions, including Christianity. And then when it comes to extraterrestrials, there is the question, would those extraterrestrials also be sentient? Would they be rational? And would they be judged just like humans would be judged? I mentioned earlier that the Quran leaves open the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe, so we don't have explicit mention of extraterrestrial spaceship commanding advanced intelligence beings. But we do have other beings being mentioned in the Quran that are not animals or not plants. And those are the jinn that we will probably come back to. But those are also the angels. Because the Quran does not specifically mention green men or gray men in UFOs, theologians would have to basically devise analogs, or they would look at what does the Quran say about these other creatures that we're sharing the cosmos with. What does the Quran say about, for instance, animals? What does the Quran say about angels? What does the Quran say about jinn? In order to then derive conclusions, what kind of aliens could God have created, and what's the fate of them?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to add, but Montessori's chapter is very exciting because he's playing the philosophical card really well. So he wants to provoke certain questions. Will there be only one day of judgment? Can there be many, right? So will there be life after this? And what does ETI look like in that matrix? Then there's also this question of identifying what is a mukallaf, a responsible individual, because that forms the foundation of legal jurisprudence, right? So if do ETI qualify that as, are they responsible agents, yay or nay? And that then links up to accountability on the Day of Judgment, because in order to be held accountable, you need to have the basic, cognitive parameters and even the physical parameters to be able to help to be held accountable in front of God. So he explores all those questions And I think all in the right way to trigger further thinking down the line. And I think for those people such as yourself, Roberto, who are interested in eschatology, I think it provides ample room to kind of, you know, look at resources within the Islamic tradition. One more thing I think I should add is that though Muhammad Muntasiri looks at very Shia resources, this is one of the few chapters that is intra-faith in the sense that it looks at both. He's mining from Sunni sources as well as Shi'i sources to provide some philosophical explorations for these conversations.
Now, talking about moral accountability, the following chapter by David Solomon Jalajel is looking at the question of human uniqueness found in Islamic tradition. Could then be extraterrestrial recognized as morally accountable persons? And this chapter also introduces the questions that Matthias just talked about, the question of jinns, which we will see later with more details. But I was wondering if you can, you know, use this discussion about this chapter to start defining this unique creature.
Thank you. You mentioned human uniqueness first. And I think that's still one of the most open questions in all of exotheology and in all of astrotheology. And that's potentially also the most challenging one. So I don't think the discovery of microbial life would be a major challenge for any of the world religions. If we found microbes on Mars or microbes or even like less advanced, less developed animals, let's say on icy moons in the solar system, this would not shake people's faith. And indeed, the Quran itself, for instance, talks about creatures spread across the heavens. However, in all the Abrahamic faiths, humans are seen as unique or are seen as very, very special creations, maybe not the most most special creations. There are arguments about whether angels are more special than humans, whether humans are favored over angels, and so on. But let's say if we were to discover advanced aliens who are smarter than us, who are more developed than us, I think that would be perhaps the most challenging thing for a lot of believers in Islam as well as in Christianity, because it would sort of raise the question, how special are we humans if there are other creatures who seem to be more favored, who seem to be more gifted than we are. Like I mentioned, we don't have an account of advanced technological civilizations in the Quran, but we do have an account of the jinn. The jinn are in some ways also quite special. They have their own chapter of the Quran named after them. There's a surat al-jinn. And they are seen as creatures of a different nature, perhaps made of fire, so made of an entirely different kind of matter than humans. They are described as intelligent, as being able to choose between good and evil. They are described as powerful, as being able to appear and disappear from our world. They are able to engage in relationships with humans, including sexual relations. And there's a whole literature outside of the Quran devoted to the jinn, a fantastical literature, including the 1001 Nights, the Alif Layla wa Layla. So maybe I'll stop here and ask whether Shoaib would like to take over.
Yeah, so just to fill in more on the content side, David Solomon's Zelazel, the author of that particular chapter, what he's trying to do is take the arsenal of the Sunni standpoint. So these include the three Sunni schools of thought, creedal schools of thought. So these are the Ash'aris, the Maturidis, and the Athari framework, the Salafi framework. And then also the four schools of jurisprudence. So the Hanafi, Hanbali, Maliki, and Shafi'i. By mining, you know, these seven camps, so to speak, what he tries to argue is that there is nothing intrinsic within the Islamic tradition that denies the possibility of rational entities outside of the category of humans, jinns, and angels. Why do I focus on those three? Because those are the ones that are acknowledged in Islamic scripture. But he's trying to show in this particular study of his that Islamic thought doesn't deny that there could be other rational entities outside of these three categories. And therefore, we should not use scripture as a way of negating those possibilities. Because what happens sometimes is that when we see an absence in scripture, some people interpret the absence of scriptural mention as the negation of that reality, which is what he's trying to counter against, and therefore provide the possibility of a legal roadwork or legal framework for non-human, for non-jinn, for non-angelic entities that could exist in our universe.
So let me move now to classical Islam. Faisal Abdallah deals with the pre-modern era, essentially. And I was wondering if you can talk about the classical views on the heavens, earths, and other beings that can be found in the Quran.
Thank you. So the classical view of the heavens was a view that is in part based on our older religions, including older Abrahamic faiths. But this is also a view of the cosmos that was heavily based on Greek scholars, ancient Greek scholars, the work of Aristotle and the work of Ptolemy of Alexandria. In the classical Islamic cosmos, the earth is at the center, and the other celestial objects orbit the earth or go around the earth. So this sun would go around the earth, the moon would go around the earth, obviously, and the other planets would go around the earth. So before the scientific revolution of the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, before Nicolaus Copernicus, essentially, people did not have, in general, the understanding that we would have nowadays, where Earth is a planet orbiting the sun. And they would also not have the understanding that the other planets necessarily are, could be other Earths either. However, in classical Islamic thought, the idea of the plurality of worlds, the idea that there is more than one world out there, the Quran itself only ever talks about the worlds in the plural. But there's never the word world, an Arabic alam, mentioned in the singular. God is described repeatedly as the Lord of the worlds in the plural, as Rabb al-Alamin, including at the very beginning of the Quran, in the Fatiha, in the opening chapter of the Quran. There are also verses that speak of seven heavens and perhaps of a similar number of earths. There are verses that speak of creatures being spread throughout these different heavens, including angels, including prophets, including creatures that are referred to in Arabic as daba, a type of perhaps animal of some kind. Shu'aib, do you want to take it from here?
Yeah, so Faisal Abdullah's chapter is my personal first favorite chapter in the entire volume. I really, really, really like it. And that's because he was able to uncover certain discussions that I personally wasn't aware of prior to this project. So he looks into the works of Abu al-Hasan al-Mawardi, Taqiyuddin al-Subki, and Jalaluddin Suyuti. These are very prominent scholars in Islamic thought. And all of them had penned down not only the possibility of registering rational agents outside of the categories of jinn, human, and angelic kinds, but also what kind of legal frameworks that can be devised around them. And I think for those people who are potentially looking at exoethics, if you want to coin that term in this podcast, exoethics, right? Ethical implications of exotheology. I think that this will provide a lot of interesting resources, because he quotes intensively from a lot of different classical manual works, and I personally really enjoy this. I thought this was a phenomenal contribution, and I think that many people who look into this volume, they'll find a lot of interest in that chapter.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I found it very, very interesting, because it's always fascinating when you look back at the pre-modern era and how people understood. And sometimes we're more open-minded than we think, acknowledging that, you know, we don't know. There may be things that we can't understand now, and so we just have to wait what's going to happen. But I want to talk about your chapter. So, Shuaib, you're discussing six potential conflicts between extraterrestrial intelligent life and Islamic beliefs. And your work is based on the earlier work of McIntosh and Dalton McNabb, the famous article, Houston, Do We Have a Problem? Extraterrestrial Intelligent Life and Christian Belief. You seem to conclude that there is no apparent or impossible conflict.
So this particular article came to my attention when I was just looking at extraterrestrials generally. This is when I was just about to interview for his book, because I had my own podcast back in the day. And this article is very interesting. So it asks like six key questions, right? Is the discussion of, or is the possibility of ETI incompatible with theism? Is it incompatible with what is said in the Bible, the central doctrines of Christianity, or just the Islamic, you know, the Christian tradition more broadly? And how might ETI exacerbate the problem of evil, a very well-known issue amongst many religious and philosophical, circles? And then finally, the overall Christian narrative. And what he simply means by that, anything that doesn't fit in the previous, five categories. And I thought that would be an excellent template to look at the Islamic angle, to see if there are any potential points of conflict. I argue in the negative that there isn't. One discussion where I think there can be a potential conflict is which is the most superior of creation. So as Matthias highlighted earlier, there's a well-known debate in classical Islam about which is the most favorable creation of God, right? Is it the angels? Is it human beings, right? Could there be a third option out there? And that discussion parallels with dissenting voices that we see in the contemporary literature. So Hamza Karmali, who is the author of the first chapter, seems to think that even if we were to find out, about ETIs, they would not be as good as human beings from the perspective of God, right? They would always be secondary, tertiary, or whatever rank you want to give them. Whereas I point to another contemporary scholar called Muzaffar Iqbal. He seems to say this is an open-ended question. It's not really clear. Humans could be, they could not be. And I think this will become the center stage of a lot of future discussions in the field of theological anthropology. That is, what defines human uniqueness? What is human nature? And how does all of this link up to, the most favorable creation of God?
So let's talk once again about the jinn. One of the least and possibly poorly understood figures in Islam. As mentioned earlier, not a human being, nor an angel. And I was wondering if there's anything that you want to add in relation to the figure of the jinn. And also, how did Richard Playford connect the jinn and alien life?
Richard Playford is among our chapter authors, I think the only one who is not from a Muslim background. He comes from a Christian background. He is an expert more on Christian theology, but he really delved deeply into the topic of the jinn for us in this chapter. And the jinn are indeed something that distinguishes the Muslim, the Islamic worldview from a broader Christian worldview. The jinn are not humans, they are not angels. They are seen as made of some kind of different substance, right? Humans are sometimes seen as made essentially out of the matter of the earth, out of soil. Angels in the Islamic understanding are generally understood to be creatures of light. And jinn are made of fire. They have something demonic about them. So they are sometimes compared to the kind of creatures that appear in like European demonological texts, right? The European imagination, European folklore, of course, had various creatures like fairies, demons, succubi, and so on. What makes the jinn special in the Islam is that they have this really, really important place in Islam, whereas demons don't have the same place. So you can believe in Christianity and not believe in demons. It would be very, very hard for you to believe in Islam and not believe in jinn, just because, for instance, they have an entire chapter named after them, and thereby also jinn have the same status in some ways as other creatures that have chapters, surahs named after them. So there's Surat An-Nahl, for instance, the chapter of the bees, or there's Surat Al-Baqarah, the chapter of the cow, and there's a chapter, Surat An-Nisa, the chapter of the women. So these are all very, very important creations of God, each one of them. And the jinn, you can't really deny the existence of jinn from a Quranic perspective, just like you can't deny the existence of bees or cows or women in that from an Islamic theological standpoint. Because the Quran does not mention spacefaring aliens, does not mention little green men in spacesuits. So if we want to find out something about other intelligent creatures that are somewhat out of our world, the jinn become a very useful analog. And as such, they have been used by Richard Playford as well as others.
Fundamentally, the whole point of Richard's chapter is that because Islamic thought posits this category called jinn kind, so to speak, which is neither an angel, neither a human being, it may have the extra resources that might obfuscate certain thinking and Christian modes of thought, in that if you just believe the ontology of rationality are just, you know, angels and human beings, nothing out there, then Islam may have certain resources that could be used to make EDI much more palatable for Muslims. That's his main discussion.
Good. So moving forward, Ayub and Ilham Ibrahim take the readers to Indonesia, which I must admit I didn't know had such an enthusiasm for UFO. And so I was wondering if you can first give us some context. And then if you can elaborate on the various hypotheses that emerged in order to make UFO sightings acceptable for Muslims.
So from a historical point of view, the modern UFO phenomenon started towards the end of World War II and sort of there in the years thereafter, so we're talking about the 1940s, the first UFO sightings were in Europe and particularly like in North America, and of course by populations that had just gone through the major World War II, by populations that had been traumatized by death that came from the air, right? World War II was heavily fought through the airs with fighter jets, with bombers, and people were very nervous about unidentified objects in the sky, technologically advanced rockets or aircraft or spacecraft. So this UFO phenomenon started in places like Roswell, for instance, New Mexico, but it globalized very, very quickly. And by the end of the 1950s, people in most countries of the world have seen unidentified flying saucers, unidentified flying objects or flying saucers. And that includes many people in the global south and in the Muslim world. Indonesia had a curious interest in the study of UFOs. So in particular in the 1970s, military officers as well as politicians wanted to know more about UFOs, wanted to include the United Nations even in the study of UFOs. A very famous astronomer, J. Allen Hynek, who I think was based at Northwestern University, where you, Roberto, taught as well. He was invited to Bosha Observatory in Indonesia to talk about UFOs. And over time, sort of local people in Indonesia who became fascinated by UFOs also looked at Islam and looked at the Quran as resources, to use the word that Shu'aib just said, for understanding the UFO phenomena, and that includes crop circles. But UFOs, this fascination with UFOs has never really left us. It perhaps came in waves, one wave after World War II in the context of the emerging Cold War, but it came back again in the 2010s and in recent years as well. Think about in the United States, for instance, the recent anxiety over Chinese spy balloons, right? So the idea of, oh, could there be mysterious objects in the air? Our authors Ayub and Ilham Ibrahim looked at this phenomenon and explored various hypotheses put forward by Indonesian UFO enthusiasts, including hypothesis that maybe these UFOs are indeed of extraterrestrial origin, or that they are coming from Earth itself.
Yeah, no, I mean, this was my second most favorite chapter in the entire volume. And just to, you know, add that what's fascinating about this is, like yourself, Roberto, I had no clue that there was an amazing community in Indonesia that, you know, were talking about all these kinds of things. So that really, you know, took me by surprise. I was like, wow, that's just phenomenal. But yes, I mean, they provide several different perspectives, right? I'm not going to go through all of them, but perhaps these UFO sightings could have been stimulated by, you know, humans, you know, maybe some secret agency, perhaps, right? It could be pre-Adamic beings, so maybe something before human beings, right? For those of you who watch Ancient Aliens, you could plug that into that if you wanted to, right? So then you've got perhaps these smart creatures that are not necessarily human in their nature, right? Things like djinn, it could be djinn. What my favorite one is this Iblis trickery hypothesis, that Satan is somehow, you know, orchestrating these to confuse believers, you know, around the world. So I thought that was very, very interesting. And that there are few more, but I think that that provides, a rich amount of data set with respect to how Indonesians are thinking about UFOs. And I just think that it'll be a great roller coaster ride if you want to know more about the Muslim world and how they're interacting in these conversations.
And so let's talk about science fiction. Now, the last chapter by Imad al-Din Aisha looks at the exotheology in Egyptian science fiction. And I think it should be said that the Egyptian film industry was often defined as the Hollywood of the Middle East, probably until now, where we can see that Turkey is taking over that role. Can you give us a sense of how Arab science fiction relates to Islamic theology? And I think it's important also to say that from a comparative perspective, that in the Western world, science fiction is divorced from God and often separated from religion.
So science fiction is a very liberated genre. Anywhere, it is a genre of a very free imagination, right? It is a genre that allows for the imagination of all kinds of different worlds, past and present. And that imagination of different worlds is in line with the Quran itself, right? So if the Quran speaks about God as the Lord of the worlds, and if God is understood to be all-powerful, and if God is understood as being capable of creating whatever worlds he wants to create, and if every world that he creates would be a sign, would be proof of the glory of God, then this in itself gives license to science fiction creators to imagine all kinds of fantastical beings, including intelligent viruses, for instance, and many, many other beings. Chapter author Imad al-Din Aisha, he is an expert on science fiction in Africa and Asia more broadly, in the Muslim world in particular, but he is based in Egypt, which is, of course, like you mentioned, has been a large producer of culture, including films, but also novels, theater plays in the Arab world. Egypt in modern times has been led largely by secular governments, and Muslim scholars, Muslim activists often found themselves in opposition to the ruling regime, to the government. So for instance, a lot of like Islamic thinkers associated with the Muslim Brotherhood were repressed, were put in prison, were facing censorship at various points between the 1950s and the present. Science fiction, however, is one of those areas where Islamic thoughts, religious thoughts can be expressed and where people can circumvent censorship. So if you have a controversial idea, a sensitive idea, maybe something related to religion or politics, and if you put this into a realist novel, then you might not be able to get that published. Whereas if you put these ideas that you have about religion and politics, if you put this into a novel that's set in a different time or on a different planet, then you're much freer in expressing those religious thoughts.
In conclusion, my understanding of the book is that there is no real contradiction between extraterrestrial intelligent life and Islam. Can you draw some conclusions and perhaps reflect on possible scenarios the day extraterrestrial life will be found?
Yeah, so I think that at least theologically, I think it's very clear from this book and from all the different exercises that our contributors have written down, is that I don't think there's any theological problem with, A, the existence of extraterrestrials, and two, us having potentially contact with them. I think we also have the jurisprudential framework to be able to engage with questions like, how do you deal with stuff like in terms of responsibility, accountability, and then further, you know, derivatives off of that. The one thing I do think where there might be avid, I'd say, disagreements is perhaps the discussion of the most favorite creation of God, like the most superior creation of God. I think that that is the only thing that sticks out to me, which might, I think, be a cause of concern for other people. So yeah, I think that this paves the way for the field of theological anthropology, which is, you know, what is the discussion of human nature and human uniqueness given the theological setting of things. And I look forward to seeing how that field evolves.
Just to mention, like, astrobiologists, people in the SETI community, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, they're looking at possible scenarios. So, for instance, they look at one scenario being the discovery of microbial life in the solar system, either on Mars or one of those moons orbiting Saturn or Jupiter. That would not be a theological problem at all. Another scenario is that we find biosignatures on an exoplanet. So we are increasingly, as humanity, developing telescope capabilities that allow us to look deep into the atmospheres of planets outside of the solar system. And then the question is, will we be able to find biosignatures, signs of life there? How conclusive would those biosignatures be? That's an open question. I don't think that would be challenging itself for Islamic theology. Also, until we can actually go to those planets, finding certain molecules in the atmospheres might still be open to debate. But the other scenario is that we find some kind of techno signature, that we find signs of a technologically advanced civilization. So not just biological processes being at work in other planets, not just microbes that we can found on, let's say, a Martian meteoroid. But if we, for instance, receive a radio message that is clearly from an advanced technological source, or indeed if we capture an image of a spacecraft, or if we have an image of an advanced spacecraft coming through our solar system, this is perhaps less likely, but if indeed we discover creatures that seem to be technologically superior to us, that seem to be smarter than us, that may have even been created before us, and so on, then we get into these very, very interesting discussions about human uniqueness, and also, like, are we indeed God's most favored creation or not?
These were Shoaib Ahmed Malik and Jörg Matthias Detterman, editors of Islamic Theology and Extraterrestrial Life, New Frontiers in Science and Religion, published by IB Tauris in 2024. Shoaib, Matthias, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. And we look forward to more conversations with you and with all our listeners. And I would like to stress that if anything, this book is only the beginning of a larger discussion that we would like to have about life in the universe and its relations to Islamic thought.
Thank you so much, Roberto. I had a lovely conversation with you. It's always good to talk about aliens whenever we can speculate about them. And just echoing what Matthias said, you know, we hope this is the start of a wonderful conversation. Hopefully many people can participate this in future dialogue.
And inshallah, we will be able to see aliens in our lifetime.
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Thank you so much, Roberto.